As Israel's genocidal war enters its 164th day, Doctors Without Borders says the situation in Gaza is catastrophic and words cannot describe it. A rights advocacy organization says Israel has systematically targeted dozens of information technology experts in Gaza as part of its genocidal war against the territory. And Russia's President Putin warns the West against sending troops to Ukraine, saying it could take the world to the brink of World War III. Hello everyone from the studios in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Now the Gaza Strip is enduring relentless Israeli airstrikes and shelling as more Palestinians have lost their lives in fresh attacks. The regime has targeted several areas near the southern city of Khan Yunis. They include Hamad town, where five dead bodies were recovered from under the rubble. Israeli warplanes also struck some neighborhoods in Gaza City and its vicinity. The regime shelled east of the Buraj refugee camp and targeted homes in the Nusayrat camp in central Gaza as well. That led to the killing of several Palestinians. Israel unleashed its war on Gaza in early October. Over 31,600 Palestinians have been killed so far. The war rages on while Gazans are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid severe food shortages. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says people in the coastal sliver are on the brink of famine. Doctors Without Borders says the current situation in Gaza is catastrophic and indescribable. A senior leader of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the group is waiting for a response to a ceasefire proposal from Israel and the US, the regime's main accomplice in the Gaza genocide. Osama Hamdan said the initiative put forward by Hamas is a realistic one with clear details. He said it provides for a swap of captives in Gaza and Palestinian abductees and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. Hamdan said the Palestinian movement had, during negotiations, called for an end to the war, the return of refugees, the dispatch of aid to Gaza, and the start of the reconstruction of the Strip. Hamdan touched upon the divisions within the Israeli regime on the war and added that Tel Aviv has achieved none of its declared objectives despite the atrocities committed in Gaza. He said Hamas has told intermediaries that acts of aggression against Gaza must stop. The Israeli regime has systematically targeted information technology experts, programmers and computer technicians as part of its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. According to Euromed Human Rights Monitor, the Israeli military has killed hundreds of people with intellects and expertise in the blockaded territory, especially those proficient in information technology, as well as other elites such as doctors and academics. The Rights Watchdog has compiled a list of technology specialists, namely those with expertise in programming and artificial intelligence, who were killed in the regime's incessant onslaught. The group says it has documents showing the Israeli military launching direct and devastating attacks on its headquarters of IT companies as well. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has raised the alarm over the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, calling for an immediate ceasefire in the coastal territory.
We are all extremely concerned about the war in Gaza and the unfolding catastrophic humanitarian situation. Gaza is facing famine, and we cannot accept this. It is critical to achieve an agreement on a ceasefire rapidly now that frees the hostages and allows more humanitarian aid to reach Gaza.
Von der Leyen also voiced concern over a full-scale offensive in the southern Gaza city of Rafah, saying it would have devastating impact on the civilian population. She made the comments in a joint press conference in Cairo with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who also spoke out against any military action in Rafah. He said Egypt and EU leaders have rejected any Israeli ground operation in Rafah that would deteriorate the humanitarian crisis further. He also reiterated Egypt's opposition to any attempt by Israel to forcibly displace the Palestinian people from their homes. Meanwhile, people in different countries across the globe continue to voice solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. In the Netherlands capital, hundreds of pro-Palestine demonstrators gathered outside the National Holocaust Museum for the second time since last week. The demonstration came as a delegation from the Israeli regime was visiting the National Holocaust Museum. The protesters held pictures of the children killed in Israeli bombings on Gaza. They called for an immediate end to the ongoing genocidal war on the besieged strip. In another European capital, London, people displayed their support for the Palestinians during a rally against racism. They called for an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Also in Italy, hundreds of protesters gathered in Milan in support of the Palestinians. The demonstrators held signs reading "Stop the genocide in Gaza" and "Stop arming Israel." The German city of Berlin was also the scene of a massive rally.
We are here to demonstrate for Palestine, and I think it's not only about Palestine here, it's also about showing our anger towards the German media and the German politicians, because they have a lot of power and they decided to take a side. And even they use sometimes some wars for a human crisis or something like this. I can't believe it. I have the feeling that it's just an empty wars.
The protesters demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. They carried blood-stained small mock body bags in reference to the large number of children killed in Gaza. In Bahrain, which has normalized ties with Israel, the protesters hailed the Palestinian resistance fighters and decried the United States for the Israeli bloodletting in Gaza. Also in Chile, in South America, a massive rally was held in the capital, Santiago, with protesters denouncing Israel for the killing of over 16,000 children in Gaza. Now, the appointment of a new Palestinian prime minister and planned formation of a new Palestinian government have sparked internal disputes and division. A senior Palestinian official says that some factions have called for national consensus and a unified Palestinian leadership before the formation of a government. Mona Kandil has more.
The appointment of a new Palestinian prime minister at the current circumstances can deepen divisions as the Israeli war on Gaza rages. This is what some Palestinian factions revealed after President Mahmoud Abbas appointed Mohammed Mustafa, a long-trusted advisor on economic affairs, as prime minister and tasked him with forming a new government. Both Hamas and resistance movements, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Palestinian National Initiative, said that without national consensus, it's a reinforcement of a policy of exclusion and the deepening of division. We met Dr. Mustafa Al-Barghouti, Secretary General of the National Initiative. He told us that the most important thing is now a unified leadership.
We're not against the new government. We're against the way the government is being formed. We want a national consensus government, a government which is acceptable and accepted by all Palestinian political groups through a national dialogue between the different groups. And that is natural because, and for us, the main goal first before forming a government is how we structure a unified Palestinian national leadership.
Mohammed Mustafa replaces Mohammed Shtayyeh, who resigned less than 3 weeks ago, citing the need for real change. Experts, however, say there had been mounting pressure on Abbas to reform the Palestinian Authority and initiate the establishment of a political framework capable of governing a future Palestinian state to take charge of all Palestinian territories after the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza ends.
First of all, that there was a pressure on Palestinian Authority to make some changes, and that's why they complied immediately and appointing Mohammed Mustafa as the new prime minister. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, which is most importantly as well, what the Palestinians wanted. The Palestinians don't want another government to be the same. The problem here is with Israel. Are they, and the international community, are they able to really make the change and let this government to work or not?
The new prime minister now would work to form a technocratic government of experts. Abbas has also asked Mustafa to create plans to reunite the administration of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, reform the government, and address internal corruption. A real political change, not a change in words only, is what the people here desire. Moreover, the upcoming government faces numerous challenges. namely rebuilding the Gaza Strip, torpedoing Israeli plans to control the coastal enclave, and managing Palestinians' lives. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has conducted fresh attacks against Israeli positions in solidarity with Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. In their latest strikes, resistance fighters targeted an Israeli airbase on the occupied Golan Heights in Syria with drones. The group said the recent attacks show resistance fighters are pressing ahead with their operations against Israeli strongholds in defense of Palestinians in Gaza. The group said the operations come in response to the Israeli genocide against Palestinians in the coastal sliver. In recent months, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israel's positions in the occupied territories and elsewhere. It has also attacked U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. In Russia, preliminary results of the presidential election show incumbent Vladimir Putin is on course for another 6-year term in office. According to Russia's Central Election Commission, Putin has garnered nearly 88% of the votes, with around one quarter of the ballots counted. None of the three other candidates has reached even 5%. Vote counting began minutes after polls closed on Sunday across the country, as well as in four Ukrainian regions annexed by Russia in 2022. For the first time, the election took place for 3 days, starting from Friday. Election officials say the nationwide turnout was over 74%. This is the 8th presidential election in Russia and the 5th term for Putin if he is declared the winner. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin has issued a warning to the West over the Ukraine war shortly after the early results of Russia's presidential election showed he'll remain in power. Putin says the presence of Western troops in Ukraine can put the world on the verge of World War III.
I think that anything is possible in the modern world, but I've already said this, and it is clear to everyone that this conflict between Russia and NATO will be just one step away from a full-scale World War III. I don't think anybody is interested in this. NATO military are present there in Ukraine. There's nothing good in this. Firstly for them, because they get killed in large numbers.
Putin also touched upon peace talks over Ukraine. He expressed Russia's readiness for talks on a French proposal for a ceasefire during this summer's Olympic Games. However, Putin said he will take into account Russia's interests on the front line of the war. The president added that Russian armed forces hold the initiative on the battlefield as they have made advances in Ukraine. On Saturday, the French president said his country will ask Moscow to observe a ceasefire in Ukraine during the Olympic Games, where Russian athletes are banned to compete under their country's flag. For the third year in a row, Afghanistan has been declared the least happy country in the world. That's according to the UN's World Happiness Report. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
The people of Afghanistan are facing immense hardship and sorrow, with the country finding itself at the bottom of the World Happiness Report rankings. The report, which evaluates nations based on various factors such as freedom, health, and income, has named Afghanistan as the unhappiest, where almost everyone is very unhappy.
Everyone here agrees with the result of the World Happiness Survey. We are unhappiest, and that is because of the ongoing poverty, unemployment, and lack of freedom and opportunities. Furthermore, girls cannot receive education, which further adds to the misery of Afghan families. When women are despaired, families feel unhappy.
I have been unemployed for almost 3 years. Since then, I have not had any income. My young daughters are missing their school, and this situation is so tough. How can we be happy? The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
As we speak, mental clinics across Kabul are receiving more patients than ever. As a psychologist, I witnessed the rise of mental health problems such as anxiety, stress, and depression. They have even led to suicide. If you take hope away from people, it will result in a depressed and dead nation. Hope is everything for human beings. If it is eroded, all progress will be lost.
The Afghan people are resilient, but the absence of basic human necessities and rights can crush even the strongest will. The international community and the ruling Taliban share a responsibility to bring some hope and light to the life of the crisis-stricken nation. Decades of foreign interventions and war have made Afghans the poorest and the saddest people on the planet. This nation has long yearned for peace and happiness, but it remains to be seen when or whether they find their lost dream. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And last but not least, President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump continue to move towards a rematch in November after clinching their party's presidential nominations. Both nominees have been exchanging jabs as campaigning intensifies.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Thirty ayahs, 30 days. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors. Every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty, so the ulema, that is, Muslim scholars, took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. In the sixth episode of the Ramadan special series, we will touch upon ayahs 55 and 56 of Surah Ma'idah of the Noble Quran. These ayahs are about God-given authority and leadership among the faithful. Stay tuned, please. The blessed month of Ramadan is the month in which we feel the presence of God more in life. Human beings do not live alone in society. They are rather like a football team with certain laws and regulations. Everyone should be committed to these laws and regulations. These laws include what we eat, what we wear, when we sleep, and so on. All religions are such. For instance, if you are a member of Manchester City, you are not allowed to put on the clothes of Liverpool and vice versa. Once we embrace Islam, we cannot do whatever we like. This is true for a Christian, a Jew, a Buddhist, and followers of other creeds. If a member of a football team obeys the orders of the coach and the club, he will attain validity and respect. The same is true about religious laws and orders. For sure, a great team will gain great results if it has a competent and a skillful coach to lead it. The importance of coach or leader is so high that, according to the narrations, God is far glorious than leaving the earth without a leader, Imam. Now the question is that, who can be the leader? Different schools and faiths have answered this question differently. Some say that whoever owns more power deserves to be the leader and dominate over others. In other words, might is right. This is law of jungle. Others maintain that whoever is wiser and more prudent should be the leader. Still another group believes that whoever is accepted by people should rule over them as leader. But God says in Ayah 55 of Surah Ma'idah, "Your guardian is only Allah, His apostle, and the faithful who maintain the prayer and give the zakat while bowing down." The ayah says that our guardian is Allah. Then it continues that the prophet is Allah's representative on earth. But after him, guardianship of people is given to the faithful who maintain the prayer and give zakat, while even if they are bowing down in prayer. It wants to say that it is only the faithful who are concerned about the needs of the poor that deserve to be the leader and guardian of society. According to many exegetes of the Noble Quran, the faithful in this ayah refers to Imam Ali, peace upon him, who gave his ring to a beggar while bowing down in prayer. After specifying the guardian and leader in society, the next ayah, that is ayah 56 of Surah Ma'idah, says, "And whoever takes for his guardians Allah, his apostle and the faithful should know that the confederates of Allah are indeed the victorious." This ayah demonstrates the course of ultimate victory and success, which is achieved through obeying Allah and whoever He determines. Allah, addressing the Prophet, says in Ayah 31 of Surah Ali Imran, "Say, if you love Allah, then follow me. Allah will love you and forgive your sins, and Allah is all forgiving, all merciful." According to this ayah, acceptance of guardianship or velayat of the Prophet and obedience to him are the conditions for loving Allah. Man should know both the wali, that is the guardian, and his duty towards him. Of course, disobedience is accompanied with love. A person who accepts God-given authority and leadership of a guardian, an imam, will spend his whole life in the service of Islam, but just in the front that his imam tells him. In the time of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, two Muslims had a dispute. They went to the Prophet for judgment. When the Messenger of God issued the verdict, the one whom the verdict was against, was upset. So God revealed Ayah 65 of Surah Nisa. But no, by your Lord, they will not believe until they make you a judge in their disputes. Then do not find within their hearts any dissent to your verdict and submit in full submission. Therefore, acceptance of velayat, or God-given authority and imamat, means to submit wholeheartedly. Surely, submission in heart needs reasonable and rational prelude. It is not compulsory. After the passing away of the Prophet, his infallible successors became the Imams of the Ummah, one after the other, till the time of the 12th and last of them, Imam Mahdi, may God expedite his reappearance. But he is in occultation, and Muslims cannot enjoy him directly. So, in such conditions, who is the guardian and leader of Muslims? Has Allah left them on their own? Upon the start of the occultation of Imam Mahdi, he was in contact with people via special representatives. One of them asked the Imam the above-mentioned question. Imam Mahdi answered, "As for the new events and circumstances, refer to the narrators of our hadith, since they are my vicegerent to you, and I am Allah's vicegerent." The narrators of hadith mean those who enjoy high level of knowledge, whereby they can differentiate between valid and fake hadith, and are expert in deduction of laws from the ayahs of the Quran, and the practice and statements of the Prophet and his infallible successors. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "Whoever among you narrates our hadith and looks at our halal, permitted deeds, and haram, forbidden deeds, and recognizes our laws, accept him as arbiter. Indeed, I ordain him as your ruler." Thus, Imam Mahdi calls on all his followers to refer to the just and pious jurisprudence which are manifested by sources of emulation, maraje, especially in the form of velayat-e-faqih, authority of jurisprudence. The Iranian people accepted Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, as vali-e-faqih, jurisprudence with God-given authority, and obeyed his commands as the commands of Imam Mahdi. This unified obedience yielded the sweet fruit of victory of the Islamic Revolution and has resulted in countless success ever since. The followers of Imam Khomeini obeyed him till the last drop of their blood. In February 1982, Hanzale Battalion was under siege of the Iraqi forces. The Iranian combatants resisted for 5 days without food and water. The RTO, that is radio telephone operator of the battalion, contacted with the great commander of the division, Haj Muhammad Ibrahim Hemmat, saying, "My wireless is running out of battery. The forces were martyred one by one. The Iraqis will come soon to shoot the coup de grace. I also bid farewell." Haj Hemmat said while crying, "Don't cut the contact. Say whatever you like." The RTO continued, "Give our greetings to Imam Khomeini and tell him, quoting from us, just as you had ordered. We resisted like Hussein. We stayed and fought till the end."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and our condolences to you all, since today is the 7th of the month of Ramadan. This is the day when Abu Talib, the primordial Muslim and defender of Islam and Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, left the world. Here is a statement worth pondering upon from his bereaved nephew, the Almighty's last messenger. The Quraysh could not raise a hand against me until my uncle, Abu Talib, died.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Allah wants to bring you close in the holy month of Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here, holy month of Ramadan, talking about Islamic lifestyle on A to Z. So, dear friends, in the holy month of Ramadan, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mighty, the exalted, the creator, the Lord, the sustainer, the provider of sustenance, life, and death, Allah in the holy month of Ramadan wants to bring you close to Him. You know, sometimes, as we have said in some of our previous programs, we have a tendency to really forget what the essence of some of the actions that we do really are. And so, because of that, we end up doing these actions, or we do these practices, or we have this very superficial belief of the things that we believe in. It's not an in-depth belief. It is not a profound understanding of what is happening. And the holy month of Ramadan, unfortunately, for many of us, including myself, is a very superficial understanding of the holy month of Ramadan. Now, what we're saying here is that Allah in this holy month wants to bring you close to Him. Of course, because of the fasting and because of the spiritual strength which we gain on one hand, and two, the materialistic detachment which we acquire during the holy month of Ramadan, all of this brings us close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It spiritually builds and establishes a connection with the Almighty Allah. And so this is what we find is happening in this holy month. The holy month is an opportunity to be able to establish a connection with Allah, the Almighty, the All-Exalted, the Glorified. Another thing, though, before we go to the break, we are continuously reminding ourselves on the program that these things that we learn in the holy month of Ramadan should not be limited to this holy month. These are all things that right from day one we can continue in the rest of the months of the year and make them a part of our Islamic lifestyle.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A2Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how Allah wants to bring you close to Him in this holy month of Ramadan. What a beautiful statement this in itself, right? A lot of times we say things, we don't really think about them. But this statement in itself, the fact that in this holy month of Ramadan, Allah wants to bring us close to Him. What a beautiful statement, what a profound statement that the Almighty Allah, the Creator, the Lord, He wants us to be close to Him. Now, this Allah's wanting us to be close to Him, God's wanting us to be near to Him. What's really interesting is that technically it's of no use to the Almighty Allah, the Almighty God. What does God have to benefit from if we are close to Him or we are not close to Him? So what I'm trying to say is that it is our benefit to be close to God. It is our salvation, it is our prosperity, it is our eternal bliss, it is our happiness. It is, I guess from A to Z, it is totally our benefit and it is our advantage and it is good for us to be close to the Almighty Allah. And even though all of the blessings and all of the prosperity and all of the eternal bliss is for us when we are close to the Almighty Allah, yet it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who is asking us and trying to bring us close to Him. And so, like I said, it's a very profound statement, and you really just begin to understand a glimmer, or you see a glimpse of the compassion and the love and the mercy of the Almighty Allah. And so, in something to take into consideration, that Allah is wanting us to be close to Him in this holy month of Ramadan, and why not accept that invitation and with sincerity and purity go through our fasting in this holy month. May Allah accept it from every single one of us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Palestinian mosques.
Part 1.
The Azan, The Islamic call to prayer reverberates from mosques throughout the city of Gaza. Five prayer times each and every day summon Allah's faithful servants. Since the period of the first Intifada in the year 2000, religious awakening has grown dramatically in the Gaza Strip. At that time, the number of mosques was estimated to be 500. Statistics 14 years later in 2014 show that this number has now doubled to nearly 1,000 mosques, which are attended by hundreds of thousands of Muslims both night and day.
And the teaching of the Muslims, they have the forgiveness, which they call it in Arabic, samah. So, to forgive someone, supposed to have love.
There is a striking image, which is evident in almost every Palestinian city. In the neighborhood of Zaytun in Gaza City, for example, you can see the Katib al-Wilaya Mosque, situated next to the Roman Orthodox Church, the Church of Porphyry. This living example, witnessed for centuries, proves that fraternity and tolerance between the Muslim and Christian communities is indeed possible, and how the fate of each community is linked to that of the other in the land of Palestine.
Christians and Muslims, we have to live together in love because we are the creation of God and the God is one. So, special here in Gaza, Christians and Muslims are living in a very good relationship, very close relationship, because we are living as a family. We participate together, Christians and Muslims, in their festivities, in their social life, social events.
We all share the same concern for the martyrs and for the wounded. We suffer together, which prompts the Christian to host the Muslim and vice versa, so that we introduce to the whole world a demonstration of brotherhood between Muslims and Christians in Gaza and Palestine at large.
The fraternity among Muslim and Christian communities was also demonstrated when the ferocity of the most recent war, imposed by Israel on the Gaza Strip in 2014, escalated to an inhumane degree that shocked the world when the Israeli occupation army invaded border areas indiscriminately, killing men, women, and hundreds of children, and displacing thousands of ordinary citizens who were forced to seek asylum to safer shelters. Churches and Christian homes served as shelter for thousands of victims.
We refused to leave from the beginning. The Israelis dropped flyers from their planes asking us to leave, but we refused up until yesterday and the day before. All of Beit Hanun was flaring under phosphorus bombs emitting poisonous gas, and the F-16s in the sky and tanks on the ground. We waited until daylight to leave while our house was destroyed. Allah grants victory to the resistance.
We accept the people in the church because we are very close in the area when they were hitting the Israeli army. We are very close to Shajaiya and Zaytun. We are in Zaytun. And so many people from Betlahia, Beit Hanun and Shajaiya, which they were supposed to leave their places, because it was hitting their places from the tanks. So they run to find a safe place. Safe place, it is the mosque or the church. A young father or a young woman carrying a baby on his hands or her hands, you cannot close your eyes. Your heart speak and you have to apply. So this is the cause that we open the doors of the church and to accept the people.
The compassion and empathy did not stop at the churches hosting displaced persons, but even more was offered, providing environments to Muslims to lead Islamic prayers in their churchyards.
During the Ramadan time, so this it was very difficult time for the people. It was the holy day of Al-Qadr, which they call it in Arabic, which supposed these people to pray during the night time. So the church respects everybody. So what we have done, we gave to them all the freedom, all the permission to pray down in the yard of the church without no comments.
Tragedy unites communities. The Israeli occupation forces were livid to discover this Muslim-Christian unity, so they decided to open fire on a church in an effort to spoil this rising affinity and sympathy under the false pretext that they observed rocket fire coming from the church grounds. This was a war on people, not a war on Hamas, by an entity which has a long history of massacring the innocent since 1946.
This situation explains the relationship between the Muslims and the Christians in the Gaza Strip as we share the same experience and sorrow together while we walk towards the liberation of our goods Jerusalem and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Israel targeted places of worship and even schools, universities, hospitals and cemeteries with their attacks, gross violations of international law that reflects the moral depravity and severity of the Israeli occupation army and indirectly the complicity of Western nations, whose medias and governments widely ignored the deliberate targeting and bombing of churches and mosques in the Gaza Strip. In all, more than 200 mosques were blown up with debris raining down on the heads of innocent worshippers.
The Israeli occupation reduced 74 mosques to rubble, while 179 more were directly hit by this aggression. Several mosques were destroyed on top of the heads of worshippers, such as Al-Ghassam Mosque in Al-Nusayrat of Middle Governorate. They were killed while waiting for the dawn prayer service to begin.
Al-Ghassam Mosque in Nusayrat, also known as the Grand Mosque, used to be the largest mosque in the middle zone of Gaza, where it is densely populated, after an Israeli airstrike reduced it to dust. All that is recognizable now is the minaret. The claim that mosques were being used to harbor weapons and tunnels is unproven and denied by local residents.
The occupation army contacted us on Saturday, August the 8th. The caller introduced himself as Officer Musa, asking whether this was Yahya At-Tawil's house. My husband answered in the affirmative. The officer informed him that we have 5 minutes to evacuate, as they are intending to target Al-Ghassam Mosque. The officer hung up and my husband rushed to inform the neighbors.
My mobile phone rang. Neighbors called to inform me the mosque was going to be bombed. Four young men were back there getting themselves ready for prayer inside the mosque. I don't know how I managed to flee the place.
We were 13 people. My husband quietly told us we have to evacuate as the Al-Ghassam Mosque was going to be targeted. We dressed and went to my brother-in-law's house in this tower. The mosque was hit 3 minutes later.
I was escaping when just 3 to 40 meters behind me, they hit the place with another missile. The vicinity was covered with dust and smoke. It was horrifying. My neighbors and beloved ones were calling, asking where I was. I told them I was outside the mosque, but four young men were inside and I had no idea what happened to them.
In the early morning hours following the bombardment, two bodies were retrieved while the third, the body of my son Zodi, remained somewhere under the rubble. They searched for 3 days with an excavator but found nothing. The search was called off but resumed again after 60 days. The excavator operator came across my son Zodi's body then.
He was next to them. We thought he was somewhere else. This means the young men were here. Two of them were recovered. One of whom was waiting here while another was hiding in the corner. We found him in this corner a month and a half later.
القرنة هذه يعني باقي لابد فيها بعد شهر ونص لقيناها في القرنة هذه بالضبط.
كل الشقق اللي تحت تضررت.
The whole apartment underneath us sustained damages while the barrier between us and the mosque was removed. Our home and the shop sustained a great deal of damage.
والمحلات كثير يعني تضررنا.
The entire pulpit flew into the house. The electrical generator was this side, but ended up landing in Abu Zia family's grocery shop. Can you see this repair shop where the electrical generation entered? Can you see what the shop looks like now? A 60 kilo electrical generator flew to the shop.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
One of the key buts on the reported factors of the unwavering U.S. support for the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza is the overwhelming presence of Zionist Jews in the Joe Biden administration. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, these Zionist Jews exert enormous influence in the American power corridors and enjoy unconditional support from the U.S. president, who has on numerous occasions boasted of being a Zionist himself. The presence and influence of Zionist Jews in the White House has always been a point of discussion. However, since the events of October 7th, it has manifested itself in many ways. Biden administration's vetoes of ceasefire resolutions in the UN Security Council, which drew widespread condemnation from pro-Palestine groups, rekindled the debate about the Zionist influence. Raising the issue of dominance of Zionist Jews in the U.S. administration and policy circles is often seen through the prism of anti-Semitism in the West, even though the same people paradoxically like to boast about the disproportionate number of Jews in other fields. The Zionist Jewishness of Biden's cabinet was pointed out recently by The Forward, a progressive media for a Jewish American audience, as well as the Israeli right-wing newspaper Times of Israel. Being a Jew should not be seen as a problem, but those in the Biden administration have clearly exhibited the tendencies of Zionism, not only justifying the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza, but also lobbying for more financial and military aid to the occupying regime. There are also non-Jewish Zionists whose support is motivated by Christian Zionism or belonging to pro-Israel lobbies, a common case in the ranks of the Republican Party. The problem lies in the fact that everyone in the Biden administration is a radical Zionist who will uncompromisingly justify the Zionist regime's war crimes, with slight disagreements over relatively minor issues, such as illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In the American mainstream media, voting in the UN Security Council and supporting the genocidal destruction of Gaza is treated as common sense and a natural course of action. Biden made no secret of his Zionist inclinations, uttering the words, "I am a Zionist," and he has proved it through numerous pro-Israeli activities in his decades-long political career. One of them is the placement of Jewish Zionists in top positions in his administration, which at the beginning of 2021 evoked a popular joke on social networks that the West Wing would have a minion. The Hebrew term minion means the minimum number of males required to constitute a representative community of Israel for liturgical purposes. Biden's initial lineup includes Antony Blinken as Secretary of State, Merrick Garland as Attorney General, Avril Haines as Director of National Intelligence, Ronald Klain as White House Chief of Staff, Rachel Levine as Assistant Secretary for Health, Alejandro Mayorkas as Secretary of Homeland Security, and Janet Yellen as Secretary of Treasury. One level down are David Cohen as Deputy CIA Director, Eric Lander as Science and Technology Advisor, and Neuberger as Deputy National Security Advisor, and Wendy Sherman as Deputy Secretary of State. In the meantime, Victoria Nuland took the position of Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Ed Siskel as White House Counsel, and Klain was replaced by Jeff Zients as Chief of Staff. Others appointed by Biden include Ned Price as a spokesperson for the Department of State, Jennifer Klain as Executive Director of the White House Gender Policy Council, as well as a large number of ambassadors. The Zionist envoys include Michael Alder, David Cohen, Rahem Emanuel, Eric Garcetti, Mark Gainstein, Amy Gutman, Jonathan Kaplan, Yael Lempert, Alan Leventhal, Randy Levine, Jack Liu, Jack Markell, Constance Milstein, Mark Nathanson, Mark Ostfield, David Pressman, Daniel Rosenblum, and Mark Stanley, among others. Blinken, the top American diplomat, comes from a Zionist family. His grandfather, Morris, was one of the early American Zionists and the founder of the American-Palestine Institute in the years before the declaration of the Zionist entity. His institute funded economists to prepare a report on the economic viability of such an entity and lobbied Washington to politically support its creation. Following Blinken's appointment as the top U.S. diplomat, replacing Mike Pompeo, the Zionist regime media praised his and Biden's close relations with Tel Aviv during the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, noting their lifeline support for Israel and its security. During the Obama administration, Blinken often justified Zionist regime's aggressions in the region with the backney phrase, the right to self-defense, and praised Trump for strengthening the Zionist regime's regional alliances. He was a close confidant of the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Ron Dermer, who could call him in the middle of the night for pro-Israeli services, such as lobbying hard to have Israel's Iron Dome air military system financed with American taxpayer money. In his first days in office, he also made it known that the new Biden administration would support earlier Trump's decision and keep the American embassy to the occupied territories in the occupied Al-Quds. Last year, during the bickering between Biden and Netanyahu, Blinken pledged enduring U.S. ties with the Zionist regime, seeing it as a far more important ally than NATO member Turkey. As for Mayorkas, even the Israeli media boasted of his strong family ties to Tel Aviv and praised him for the data-sharing pact between the United States and the Zionist regime. Even greater Zionist credit for intelligence sharing goes to CIA Deputy Chief David Cohen, whose career under Obama focused on sanctioning Israel's enemies. Thus, it is no surprise that Americans are bankrolling the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza while harping about ceasefire and aid drops to hoodwink the international community.